Listen, I want to pick up where we left off in the book of Numbers, and we'll be going through, I don't know how far we're going to get tonight, because this chapter 7 in the book of Numbers is one of those things. I almost feel sorry for Mark, because here he is the second time he's come, and we're going to be going through all kinds of repetition. I think chapter 7 of Numbers, it's got to be one of the most neglected chapters in the entire Bible. And if I'm not mistaken, I think it's around the second to longest chapter in the entire Bible. But there's a great deal of repetition. It almost seems monotonous and bland on the surface. But again, I just go back to what we read in Galatians 3:19, where Paul says that, basically that the law that is given to us in the Old Testament is our tutor, it's our teacher. It all points to Christ in one way, shape, or form or any other. So whenever I read something, I always say, okay, now how does this apply to Christ? What is this telling us about him? Because this is our tutor, this is our teacher. And that's why I absolutely refuse to skip over any chapters or any books or any words for that matter or any names. Because I think it's like Paul tells us in the New Testament that all scripture is given to us for our instruction, for our edification, for our example, and for our reproof and these type of things. So anyway, let's get started in this, verse 1 in chapter 7. Where Moses writes, says, "Now it came about on the day that Moses had finished setting up the tabernacle. He anointed it and consecrated it with all of its furnishings and the altar and all its utensils. And he anointed them and consecrated them also. Then the leaders of Israel and the heads of their father's household made an offering. They were the leaders of the tribes. They were the ones who were over the numbered men. It says, and when they brought their offering before the Lord, 6 covered carts, 12 oxen, a cart for every 2 of the leaders, and an oxen for each one. Then they presented them before the tabernacle. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, accept these things from them, that they may be used in the service of the tent of meeting, that you shall give them to the Levites, to each man according to his service. So Moses took the carts and the oxen and gave them to the Levites. 2 carts and 4 oxen he gave to the sons of Gershom according to their service, and 4 carts and 8 oxen he gave to the sons of Merari according to their service under the direction of Itamar, the son of Aaron, the priest. But he did not give any to the sons of Kohath, because theirs was the service of the holy objects which they carried on their shoulder. And the leaders offered the dedication offering for the altar when it was anointed, so the leaders offered their offering before the altar. Then the Lord said to Moses, let them present these offerings 1 leader each day for the dedication of the altar." Okay, before we go any further, just backing up here. Basically what he says here is now this tabernacle has been completely constructed, completely put together, and now they're going to anoint the priest, they're going to anoint all the holy objects before they put them into use, okay? But they're also basically taking up a collection from each tribe, and they have one of the leaders from each tribe. Remember when we read earlier in this book where they took a census? Well, they had a leader of each tribe. He was in charge of the census and had to get a head count of all the numbered men that could go to war. Well, these same men were the ones responsible for taking up a collection from their tribes to present it to the Lord in order to facilitate the entire religious service that they were going to have. Now, what they said is that what was contributed in these verse 10, 11 verses that we read was it says that they contributed some oxen and some wagons for the use when they would be traveling. And see, whenever God would decide to pick up camp and move on, of course, they'd have to just take all of the articles from the tabernacle, and they'd have to either carry them, on their shoulders, or they'd have to put them on carts. And so what he says here, he says that he gave 4 carts, and that verse 8 says, he gave 4 carts and 8 oxen he gave to the sons of Merari. They were the ones who had the heaviest load. So when they take down everything, they had to carry all of the pillars, all the sockets, all the heavy things they had to put together, and they had to place it on a cart in order to carry it. And then the Gershonites, they were the ones who carried all the curtains, all the hangings from the tabernacle, all right? But then he said the Kohathites, they were the ones who, they weren't given any oxen, they weren't given any carts, because they had to carry everything on their shoulders. And what I mean by everything is they had to carry the most holy things on their shoulder. They had to carry the altar of incense, they had to carry the Ark of the Covenant, they had to carry the table of showbread, they had to carry the lamp, and also the brazen altar. And all of these were accommodated by poles in which to carry them on, and they had to carry them on their shoulders. Now, I don't know if anybody remembers when we went through the 2 Samuel, I think it's chapter 6, we read a situation there when what had happened was that for many years the Ark of the Covenant was not brought into Jerusalem. I think it was at a man's house by the name of Abinadab. And it had been there for many, many years. And David decided, well, yeah, you know, let's bring the Ark of the Covenant into Jerusalem and set up the tabernacle there. And the Lord will be in our midst and it'll be great. And he was all enthusiastic about it. He got about 30,000 men to go with him. They went down to Abinadab's house. And what they did is they put the Ark of the Covenant on a brand new cart, which was being pulled by oxen. And they were pulling this cart, and everybody was celebrating. They were playing music. They were just celebrating, having a grand old time, you know, thinking, oh, great, we're bringing the Ark of the Covenant, we're bringing the Lord into Jerusalem. Well, what happened is the oxen stumbled, and Uzzah reached out to steady the Ark, and he grabbed hold of the Ark, and the Lord just struck him dead right there. And it just put, everything went to dead silence. And David, it says, got angry. He just said, why did God do that? What's the deal? Why? I don't understand this. He was really, really angry. And then he felt like, hey, we can't bring the ark in here. And so what happened is they brought it to this particular man's household to just stay. And about 3 months later, David found out that this particular household where the ark was at, it was really being blessed to the Lord. So David said, well, let's bring the ark back. But then he did it the right way. He got the priest to carry the ark the way it was supposed to be carried. Because what would happen is they would take this Ark of the Covenant and they would actually take the veil, the holy, holy veil, and they would wrap it around the Ark of the Covenant, and then they would take that porpoise skin or whatever it was and they'd wrap it around the outside of the veil so that you couldn't even see the Ark of the Covenant. But the Ark of the Covenant itself had holes in it or latches in it so they could carry it on poles. So the priests had to carry the Ark on their shoulders. And that was very significant because when they were carrying the ark on their shoulders, you know, they had four priests, you know, each at one end of the pole, and they were carrying this ark. It would be almost like symbolically they were uplifting and exalting God, and also they would be in a position where God would be guiding and directing them. And for them to put the ark on a cart was strictly forbidden. Yeah.
Does it say who put the ark on the cart? Why weren't they stricken dead?
Well, I'm assuming it doesn't say who. Doesn't say who. I'm just assuming that it would have been the Levites. It would have been, you know, the priestly tribe. Okay. But, Uzzah, who touched it, he obviously wasn't part of the priestly tribe. And even if he was, it was just not done properly. So what was God trying to tell him? Again, you know, people don't get this through their head. They just don't. You know what we're dealing with here? We're dealing with a holy God. A righteous and holy God who cannot be approached in any flippant manner. This is what he constantly tried to bring home to his people. And this is what I see today all over the place, inside and outside of the churches, that people feel like, well, hey, I'm basically good, and if there's a heaven, and I'll go there. They don't understand that, no, God is an utterly righteous God, and there's only one way to God, and Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man's going to come to the Father except through me. And the Bible says over and over again, that says there's a way that seems right to a man, but the end thereof is death. It seemed right to them to do this thing, but if they would have taken the time to say, hey, okay, let's bring the ark into Jerusalem, and then they would have gone back to God's word and say, hey, well, this is the way we got to do it. We have to transport it with the greatest reverence and the greatest respect. Well, when David, you know, the second time he brought it around, then he had the priest carrying it, and he was offering sacrifices, and then, you know, everything went well. Everything went smooth. So that's what I'm saying. The Kohathites, they were the ones who were carrying these furnitures. And I'll get into the furniture in just a minute here when we go through this. But that was basically their jobs. Okay, they were given these things to serve God in that capacity, the Levites. Anyway, beginning with that verse 12 now. It says, now the one who presented his offering on the first day was Nashon, the son of Abinadab of the tribe of Judah. And his offering was one silver dish, whose weight was 130 shekels, and one silver bowl of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, and one gold pan of 10 shekels full of incense. He says, and one bull, one ram, one male lamb, 1 year old lamb for the burnt offering, and one male goat for a sin offering. And for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, five male lambs, 1 year old. This was the offering of Nashon of Abimadad. On the second day, Nathanael, the son of Zuar, the leader of Issachar, presented an offering. He presented as his offering, one silver dish whose weight was 130 shekels and one silver bowl of 70 shekels according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, and one gold pan, 10 shekels full of incense, and one bull, one ram, one male lamb, 1 year old for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen and five rams and five male goats and five male lambs and 1 year old. This was the offering of Nathanael, the son of Zerah. On the third day, it was Eliab, the son of Helion, the leader of the sons of Zebulun, and his offering was one silver dish whose weight was 130 shekels and one silver bowl of 70 shekels, and according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, and one gold pan of 10 shekels full of incense, and one bull, one ram, one male lamb, 1 year old, for a burnt offering, and one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offering, two oxen, five rams, and five male goats, and five male lambs, 1 year old. This was the offering of Eliab, the son of Helon. Now, we just read three of the tribes of Israel. We read Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. The leaders of these tribes were presenting, okay, these sacrifices. But look at how repetitious this is. This is repetitious. This is monotonous. This is boring. We're reading it. It's saying it over and over again. But I look at this and I say, okay, this is very, very, very repetitious. What's the point? Why didn't God just flat out just come out and say, each tribe contributed this to the sanctuary, and then made the list and then go on? Instead, he's listing each tribe separately, each leader separately, and each one of the gifts separately, even though the gifts are identical. They're exactly the same. What's God trying to tell us in this?
We all have something to contribute.
Good. Both of you know, if you go back to Hebrews chapter 6, okay, it tells us that God is not unjust to us to forget the love that we show towards His name in ministering and continuing to minister unto the saints. Okay, that's what it says. And God doesn't just deal in mass. He deals with individuals. And I think the emphasis here is that, hey, God takes special note of everything that we do for His namesake. That's what we're told in Hebrews. As a matter of fact, what we give for His namesake, remember the widow with her two mites when Jesus was standing in the temple and He was watching people putting money in the treasury? And some of these people who would put money in the treasury, if they were going to put an exorbitant amount in the treasury, they'd have people blow the trumpet and everybody's get everybody's attention and they'd give a big contribution and everybody'd think, that's great. Jesus was just standing there watching, and He saw this old widow with nothing more than two pennies, well, two mites, were actually amounted to about a cent, a penny. That's all she had. She put it in the treasury, and Jesus called the disciples together, and He says, do you see that what that woman gave? She gave more than all the rest, according to God's economy, you see. So when we read this here, granted, it looks redundant, it looks monotonous, it looks repetitious, it looks boring, it looks like, what's the point? You know, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but we got to keep in mind what it is that God's trying to tell us. Now, one of the things that was mentioned over and over again was a silver dish. It said it weighed 130 shekels. In other words, it weighed about 2 pounds. And He said He gave a silver bowl weighing 70 shekels, which is about a pound. And they would use this for the fine flour and for the grain offerings. All right. Now, just keep in mind, because I went through, I think, a lot of this when we went through Exodus and went through Leviticus, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it right now. But just keep this in mind. The grain offering, you know, it all pointed to Christ. Fine flour. In order to make flour, you got to take the wheat and you got to crush it, grind it. You have to just pulverize it to make it into this fine flour. All right. This is what happened to Jesus. He was marred more than any man. He was pulverized. He was beaten in our place, basically for our salvation. And these meal offerings or grain offerings were a type of Christ. Matter of fact, there was three different ways that you could offer meal offerings. You could do it by baking it. And if you baked a meal offering, it meant that it had to go into an oven. And what that really symbolized, what the tutor or teacher is trying to tell us in this law, is Christ's hidden sufferings. Remember on Jesus when He went to on the way to Gethsemane, He said, my soul is crushed unto death. When He got into the Garden of Gethsemane, it says that He sweated great drops of blood. And when He was hanging on the cross, He said, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? He suffered greatly inside that no man could see. This is what that bake offering kind of represented. And also they had a flat pan, and they had a kind of like almost like a frying pan, which they would fry this meal offering up into as well as they'd offer to God. That to me is kind of significant too, because that kind of portrayed in a way the sufferings of Christ that men seen, and then some of his sufferings that men only partially seen. All of this points to Christ. And like I said, we could spend all night on this bread offering, meal offering, and the other offerings, but I'm not going to go through that because we already went through all of that when we went through Exodus and Leviticus. But I just want to give you a brief overview. Beginning with that verse 30, let's pick up there. It says, on the fourth day, it was Eleazar, the son of Shedeur, the leader of the sons of Reuben, and his offering was one silver dish whose weight was 130 shekels and one silver bowl of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, and one gold pan of 10 shekels full of incense, one bull, one ram, one male lamb, 1 year old for a burnt offering, and one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of the peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, five male lambs, 1 year old. This was the offering of Eleazar, the son of Shedeur. And on the fifth day, it was Shelumiel, the son of Zurishaddai, the leader of the children of Simeon, and his offering was one silver dish whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver bowl of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, and one gold pan of 10 shekels and full of incense, and one bull, one ram, one male goat, 1 year old for a burnt offering, and one male goat for a sin offering. And for the sacrifice of the peace offering, two oxen and five rams and five male goats and five male lambs, 1 year old. This was the offering of Shelumiel, the son of Zurishaddai. On the sixth day, it was Eliasaph, the son of Deuel, the leader of the sons of Gad. His offering was one silver dish whose weight was 130 shekels and one silver bowl of 70 shekels, and according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, and one gold pan, 10 shekels full of incense, and one bull and one ram, one male lamb and 1 year old for the burnt offering, and one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of the peace offerings, two oxen and five rams and five male goats and five male lambs for 1 year old. This was the offering of Eliasaph, the son of Deuel. Like I said, this is pretty monotonous. It's pretty repetitious. But again, I think it's emphasizing over and over and over again that, hey, God takes very strict account and he records everything that we do for his namesake, right? I mean, it was Jesus who said, hey, if you so much as give a cold glass of water in my name, it will not lose its reward. It always amazes me. I know I've mentioned this a time and again over the years, but, you know, you look at the Indianapolis 500, it's always been dubbed the greatest spectacle in sports. Or, you know, look at the Super Bowl that's coming up. Okay, we got the playoffs this Sunday, and then they're going to have Super Bowl a couple of Sundays after that. Can you tell me who won the Super Bowl 3 years ago, or 4 years ago, or 5 years ago, or even last year? I mean, you see what I'm saying? Some of the things that we put so much importance on and so much emphasis on, the Indianapolis 500, with all the time, the money, the energy, and the effort that goes into that, and the timing and everything to win one race. Who won last year's race? Hardly anybody could tell you. But it was Jesus who said, hey, if you so much as give a cold glass of water in my name to somebody, it won't lose its reward. If you do the slightest little thing out of love for God, it's recorded. That's why I think he's gone to great lengths here in recording so much of this, you know, because he gave us the leaders of the tribes of Reuben and Simeon and Gad. And one of the things that he was mentioned there, he said that there was a gold pan, a gold box or a pan or ladle of incense, which the gold weighed about 10 shekels, which would be about, I don't know, didn't even weigh a pound, but it had the incense in it. The incense was very, very important because we know from scriptures, okay, that the incense symbolizes prayer. We know that from Revelation. We know that from other portions of scripture. And, you know, right before the veil, this is what was known as the altar of incense. Okay, inside the ark, it was right before this veil. I don't know if you can see it in this diagram here, but this is the table of incense, and this is the Holy of Holies, and that's the ark. Well, that table of incense, that symbolized prayer, all right? And it came from the sap of a tree. That's how they made incense. They would cut into a tree, they would drain the sap, all right? And the sap is the lifeblood of a tree, right? They would drain that sap, and then they would dry it out, and then they would pulverize it and pound it and crush it. And then they would use this, and they put it on the altar, and they would put a fire to it. It would give off a pleasant fragrance, aroma, all right? This symbolized prayer. But here's the thing. It came from the lifeblood of a tree. When we pray to God, it is so absolutely essential that we pray from our hearts, from our life within us. In other words, what did Isaiah say? He says, these people worship me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me, right? If we do not pray to God from inside here, our prayers just bounce off the ceiling, ricochet off the wall, and they're going nowhere. They really are. I mentioned before about this fable that I once heard about this guy who had a dream and he went into a church. It was packed with people and everybody's moving their lips and everybody's singing, but it's dead silence. You can't hear a thing in it, even though the musicians are playing and the choir is singing and everybody's lips are moving like they're praying. You can't hear a thing. And then this angel said to this guy, you know what this means? It means that nobody is reaching God. But then they heard this little 5-year-old girl in the background saying, Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. And it was the only thing that was heard in heaven because she was praying from her heart. She was praying from deep down inside. The sap of a tree, the lifeblood of a tree. That's what that incense represents, okay? And this is what, one of the things that was contributed to the work of, the tabernacle. Anyway, I think we left off. 48. It says, On the seventh day, it was Elishama, the son of Abinahud, the leader of the son of Ephraim. His offering was one silver dish, whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver bowl, and 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil, for a grain offering, and one gold pan of 10 shekels full of incense, one bull, one ram, one male goat. One male lamb, 1 year old for a burnt offering, and one male goat for a sin offering. And for the sacrifice of the peace offering, 2 oxen and 5 rams and 5 male goats for 5 male lambs, 1 year old. This was the offering of Elishama, the son of Abimahud. On the eighth day, it was Gamal, the son of Pedazur, the leader of the sons of Manasseh. His offering was one silver dish whose weight was 130 shekels, and one silver bowl and 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, and one gold pan of 10 shekels full of incense. One bull, one ram, one male lamb, 1 year old for a burnt offering, and one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of the peace offering, 2 oxen and 5 rams and 5 male goats, 5 male lambs, and 1 year old. It was the offering of Gamal, the son of Pedazur. On the ninth day, it was Abidan, the son of Gideoni, the leader of the son of Benjamin. His offering was one silver dish whose weight was 130 shekels and one silver bowl and 70 shekels according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, and one gold pan, 10 shekels full of incense, and one bull, one ram, one male lamb, and 1 year old for a burnt offering, and one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offering, 2 oxen and 5 ram and 5 male goats, 5 male lambs, and 1 year old. This was the offering of Abidan, the son of Gideoni. Now he's talking about the offerings that were given by the leaders of the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh and Benjamin. And some of the things that were listed there were, the bull and the ram and the year-old male lamb for a burnt offering. Who could tell me? Who could, just off the top of your head, what was a burnt offering signifying? What was it pointing to? What was the burnt offering?
Total consumption.
Good. Good. Just in brief background, because I went through this all when we went through Exodus and Leviticus, okay? A burnt offering is when you take the animal itself. It didn't matter whether it was a ram or a bull or a lamb, but you took the whole animal, and then you would cut up the animal. You would cut off its head. You would cut its legs. You would cut it open. You would spread out its entrails onto the altar. All right, the inner parts would be on the altar. And then the whole offering would be consumed with fire. But here's the important thing. All right, that animal was cut open and its inward parts exposed to the light. And it pointed to Christ, showing us what?
He was perfect on the inside.
Good. He was perfect inside and out. God said, you can't bring a lame animal to me, a blind animal, a sick animal, a diseased animal. Okay, but then again, even if you brought a healthy animal to God, it had to be cut open, and the inward parts, the inward entrails were to expose to the light, showing that it was perfect inside and out. It was pointed to Jesus Christ. He was perfect inside and out. What did he say about the scribes and the Pharisees and Sadducees of his day? He referred to them as being whitewashed tombs. He says, you're all clean and nice on the outside, but inside you're full of dead man's bones and putrid things, right? So it's very important to God that we don't just have a life that shows outwardly to other people that we're walking with Christ. It's got to be inwardly too, all right? This was that burnt offering, but the whole animal went up into smoke, showing it was total dedication unto God. Now, that's what it was pointing to. Okay, I think we left off at 66, didn't we? It says, on the 10th day, it was Ahiezer, the son of Amishadai, the leader of the sons of Dan, his offering was one silver dish, whose weight was 130 shekels, and one silver bowl of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour and mixed with oil as a grain offering, one gold pan of 10 shekels full of incense, and one bull, one ram, and one male lamb, 1 year old, for a burnt offering, and one male goat for a sin offering, and they sacrifice a peace offering of two oxen, and five rams, and five male goats, five male lambs, 1 year old. This was the offering of Ahiezer, the son of Amishadai. Says, on the 11th day, it was Pagiel, the son of Ochran, of the leader of the sons of Asher. Of his offering was one silver dish, whose weight was 130 shekels, and one silver bowl, 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, and one gold pan of 10 shekels full of incense, and one bull, and one ram, and one male lamb, 1 year old, for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offering, two oxen, and five ram, and five male goats, and five male lambs, 1 year old. This was the offering of Pagiel, the son of Ochran. And on the 12th day, it was Ahira, the son of Enan, the leader of the sons of Naphtali, and his offering was one silver dish, whose weight was 130 shekels, and one silver bowl of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour, mixed with oil as a grain offering, one gold pan of 10 shekels full of incense, and one bull, and one ram, one male lamb, 1 year old, for a burnt offering, and one male goat for a sin offering, for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen and five rams and five male goats, five male lambs, 1 year old. It was the offering of Ahira, the son of Enan. Okay, now we dealt with the last three tribes of the 12 tribes of Israel. We dealt with the leaders of Dan and Asher and Naphtali. There was two oxen and five rams and five male goats and five male lambs. This is for the peace offering, okay? Anybody remember when we went through Exodus and Leviticus what the peace offering was?
Fellowship.
Good. Well, here's the thing about the peace offering. The peace offering differed from the burnt offering and the whole offering in this respect. A person would bring their animal to God, and then a portion of the animal would be offered up to God on the altar, and a portion of the animal would be given to the priest for his own sustenance, for his own family, and then a portion of that peace offering was also given back to the offerer so they could partake of this. What was this foreshadowing? Anybody have any idea? Modern day communion, when Jesus Christ, when he broke the bread the night before he died, saying, do this in remembrance of me, take this and eat of this, and they also said, of the wine, this is my blood, it will be shed for you and for all mankind, so his sins may be forgiven, and do this in remembrance of me. This is our fellowship today. We no longer have the peace offering where you offer up an animal, because this animal pointed to Christ. And what happens is, when we have a proper relationship with God, we now have peace with God, and we now have fellowship with him, and we have fellowship with one another. So this is what, when you go down to communion, next time you receive communion, just think about that, that the peace offering in the Old Testament prefigured this communion. It's fellowship. That's what it was. It's a peace offering. Now you can have peace with God. That's what it was pointing to. Anyway, picking up in this verse 84, it says, this was the dedication of the offering for the altar from the leaders of Israel when it was anointed. 12 silver dishes and 12 silver bowls and 12 gold pans, each silver dish weighing 130 shekels and each bowl 70. All the silver of the utensils was 2,400 shekels according to the shekels of the sanctuary, and 12 gold pans full of incense weighing 10 shekels apiece according to the shekels of the sanctuary. All the gold pans, it was 120 shekels. All the oxen for the burnt offering was 12 bulls, all the rams is 12, the male lambs were 1 year old with their grain offering 12, and the male goats for a sin offering was 12, and all the oxen for the sacrifice of peace offering was 24 bulls, and all the rams 60, and the male goats 60, and the male lambs 1 year old 60. It was the dedication offering for the altar after it was anointed. It says, now when Moses went into the tent of meeting to speak with him, he heard the voice speaking with him from above the mercy seat, and it was on the Ark of the Testimony from between the two cherubims. Now, what he's saying, he just gave us the grand total of everything that was contributed, the sum total, okay, that was given to God for religious service, okay? And I think it's kind of significant, too, because, you know, sometimes we feel, and I know I've been going through this many years, and so has Kevin in many respects, it feels like sometimes we may feel like we're spinning our wheels, like this Bible study, it doesn't seem to be accomplishing a whole lot over the years, or, you know, what's the point to it? But I'm just saying this, okay? what happens is that we all have something that we need to give for the honor and glory of God, every one of us. And if it seems like what I have to offer is very insignificant, that's not the point. The point is this, okay? God is basically depending upon us to exercise the talents that He's given us for His glory and for His honor within the church, so that other people don't have to take up the slack. Remember when Jesus is the one that gave the parable of the talents? He said one was given 5, one was given 10, one was given 2. Of course, He gave this parable twice, all right? And He gave it with different denominations. But the point was this, okay? One of His parables, He said one was given 1 talent, 1 5, 1 10. And He said the one with 5 and one with 10, they doubled theirs. And the one with 1, when his master asked him, demanded account from him, he says, I knew you were a hard and exacting man, reaping where you didn't sow and sowing where you didn't reap, so I just buried mine. He says, here it is. And then he says, you worthless, good-for-nothing slave. You could have at least taken my money and put it in a bank so it could have drawn interest. So he took it away from him, gave it to the person with 10 talents, and he threw the guy out. Here's the thing. People don't realize this. There's not that many people that have 10 talents and 5 talents. Not everybody can be a Billy Graham or a Jim Dobson or a Chuck Swindoll. These high visibility people within the church today, these are the people with 10 and 5 talents, all right? I'm a one-talented person. Probably everybody in this room is a one-talented person. And I'm convinced of this, that if every one of us would take the one talent that God has given us, and we would use it for His glory and for His honor, we could turn this world upside down overnight. We really could. The work is not going to be done by everybody with the 10 and 5 talents. You see what I'm saying? We all need to pitch in. We all need to do our part before God, because we're going to have to account to God for the resources that He's given us and the talents that He's given us. And if we just have put them on the shelf, we're going to have to account for that. You know, He called that guy a worthless, good-for-nothing slave. And you may say to yourself, well, what's my talent? I don't know. I can't tell you what your talent is. All I can say is, hey, go to the book of Acts, and what do you see there? You see a woman by the name of Dorcas, otherwise known as Tabitha. She had one talent. God gave her the gift of sewing, and she just sewed like the wind, and she sewed coats, and she sewed the garments for the widows and the orphans and the poor and the alien. She sewed, you know, so many things for so many people out of love for God. And then she upped and died. People were just grief-stricken because of that loss, and they sent for Peter. And they were all weeping and crying, showing Peter everything that she had done for them as far as making all these garments. And then Peter went upstairs where she was laying dead on a bed, and he prayed over her, and she rose from the dead. She was the only woman in the Scriptures that had been risen from the dead. And I think God did that in a very, you know, to show people, hey, man, you don't have to do great things in life. Just do little things faithfully, like this woman did. And it will add to the sum total. And then when you add to the sum total, what were we reading here in that verse 89? It was basically, when all these things were done in order and properly the way God commissioned them to be done, then it says here that God spoke to Moses from the tent of meeting, and Moses heard him. In other words, you know, when we're following God and doing what He wants us to do, this is when we're going to get revelation from God. And this is when I think that He's really going to be able to speak to us. God doesn't reveal Himself to armchair theorists or people who just simply are just going to give Him mental assent or head acknowledgement. But people to get serious with God, God reveals Himself to them. All right? And I think that's what this verse 89 is showing in this chapter 7. Does anybody have anything to add or share to this chapter 7 we just read?
I just think there are a lot of gifts, and they're not like yours would be teaching or expounding on God's Word or whatever, but you could have a gift of just encouragement, or a gift of hospitality, or a gift of prayer. Some people might not even know what you're good at, you know?
Right. Well, you know what? You said the gift of prayer. I mean, when Jesus said to that worthless slave, He said, you could at least put my money in the bank. That really was referring to the fact that you could have at least prayed. All right? That's it. You could at least have done that much. I look at people that, you know, like look at like Brad, for example, in that wheelchair. Or there's a number of people who are on their back, who are invalid, who are physically incapacitated one way or shape or form or the other, and you wonder, well, what's their talent? And I say, you know what, I don't know what the talent is, but I do know this. We all can pray, and prayer is absolutely essential for spiritual growth and victory, and prayer's answer. I mean, that's it. I mean, if we can't do anything else, that's something that we can do. And like I said, there's all kinds of different gifts. I mean, there's a list of gifts in Corinthians, there's some in Ephesians, and there's different. I mean, there's not just apostles and prophets and teachers, but there's also like the gift of tongues, the gift of healings, the gift of miracles, but there's also the gift, like you said, the gift of mercy, there's the gift of compassion, there's the gift of helps. I mean, whenever I think of the gift of helps, I always think of Kevin. I mean, he's always in the background, you know, always. I mean, I don't care whether it's up a retreat or it's here or wherever it is, you know, the guy is absolutely instrumental to the functioning of the body, all right? Paul says we can't all be the eye, we can't all be the ear, we can't all be the nose, we can't all be the mouth, all right? And some people say, well, gee, you know, oh, what am I? I'm just a toe, I'm nothing. I tell you what, you ever stub your toe? You ever stub it? I mean, stub it really bad. And it seems like it just throbs and it gets black and blue and raspberry. And guess what? You're constantly bumping it, aren't you? I mean, you never give your toe a second thought. But let me tell you something. Once you hit it, that's all you can think about, man. You see what I'm saying? We may think that we are insignificant, but I'm telling you, not in God's eyes. And He's got a purpose. He's got a plan. And put it this way. Jesus Himself said, if you are faithful in little things, you'll be faithful in big things. If you are unfaithful in little things, you'll be unfaithful in big things. If you are dishonest in little things, you'll be dishonest in big things. It's almost as though what God is saying to a person who feels like, well, gee, I don't have much to give, He's saying, well, whatever you have, give it. All right? Remember the little boy with the meager lunch? And when Jesus said, he had 5,000 people to feed, just the men alone. And he said, well, what do you have on hand? And Philip said, well, we got this lunch over here. You know, a few loaves of bread, a couple of fish. And what good is that with all this mob? And Jesus said, hey, have them all sit down and recline in circles of 50 and 100. And then he blessed it. He said, this is a little boy's lunch. But you see, if the little boy said to himself, hey, well, wait a minute, this is mine. You can't have that. Jesus wouldn't have been able to work this. But he gave it to Jesus. Jesus blessed it and he distributed it. And they ended up with like 12 baskets left over. You see, this is the thing. We look at our resources and say, man, this is nothing. This is nothing. This is a joke. This is meaningless. What can this accomplish? I'm telling you, put your talent in the hands of God, and He will bless it. He will multiply it. He will magnify it for His glory and for His honor. And I'm telling you, that little good kid probably went home and told his mom, you know that lunch you made for me? It fed over 5,000 men. You know? The men alone. Of course, she probably slapped him for being thinking he's dishonest, but you know what I'm saying? It's like, if we would just give over to God what He wants us to use and use it for His glory, you know, then I think the church would be able to grow and to function, and people would really get on fire for God. But we got the overwhelming majority of people in the church with one talent just sitting on it. You know, what do? They go to church and they just shine a pew with the rear end twice a year, once a week. And what are they doing? You know, have to answer to God for it. That's what I'm saying. You know, we got to go out there and serve God. There's a time and a place for everything. A time for worship and there's a time for service. And I think that this is what God is trying to instill in His people. And it's got to be done in the right way, in the right manner. Well, of course, with the right attitude. Anybody have anything you want to add or share to that? Like I said, it was one of the toughest chapters you're going to go through in the Old Testament. I mean, in the whole Bible. And I think it's the second longest chapter in the Bible, almost 90 verses. And it's very, very redundant and repetitious. But even that is, I think, instructive. With the natural mind, I read that and I think, why didn't he just say it once and said everybody did it? You know, no. God did it over and over and over again to tell us what? Everything's recorded. Everything people do. And I'm not taking this for granted. I don't deal in mass. I don't save in mass. I don't deal in mass. I deal with individuals, and everything is written down. Okay, go ahead.
God instructed them to bring specific things, right? They didn't think of this themselves.
He gave them the instructions, okay? Right. Good point. All right, they just didn't bring this, you know, everybody bring what they want to bring or what they thought they should bring. No, they were given specific instructions of what to bring. But the people, they still had to collect it, and the people still had to contribute it. But then everything was the same. You notice that? Anyway, let's pick up on this chapter 8. In verse 1 it says, then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to Aaron and say to him, when you mount the lamps, the seven lamps will give light in the front of the lampstand. Aaron therefore did so, and he mounted its lamps on the front of the lampstand, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. Now this was the workmanship of the lampstand, the hammered work of gold. From its base to its flowers, it was a hammered work according to the pattern which the Lord had showed Moses. So he made the lampstand. Okay, now it's talking about the lampstand, and I think the lampstand is very, very significant. Like I said, all of this stuff, it points to Jesus Christ. Everything that was set forth within this tabernacle. All right, this lamp, It says it was made out of a talent of gold. Now, a talent of gold, we don't know exactly how much a talent of gold is. It's believed to weigh as much as like 75 pounds. How much is gold going for an ounce nowadays? It's about $500 an ounce. I mean, we're talking almost $1 million, okay, what this thing is worth, right? All right? But this is a very bad picture, all right? It's a very bad picture of the lamp, because the lamp, it actually had a long stem or a stand on it, and then it had a base on it, and then what it had was seven lamps, okay? This is called, I guess they call it a menorah, whatever it is, what this lamp looked like. But here's the thing. It was one piece. In other words, they just didn't hook the branches onto a stem. This thing was all beaten out, all right, in one piece, all right? And it really pointed to Christ in a very, very unique way, because Jesus himself said, I am the light of the world, right? And he also said that we are the light of the world, all right? And if we go back to the book of Revelation, when John is on the island of Patmos, he sees Jesus walking among the lampstands. And these lampstands also were a prefigurement of the church, because Jesus Christ was walking around among them. But here's a couple of interesting things about this lampstand. It was a beaten work, all right? And it was made out of talent of gold. And the fact that it was beaten points to Christ as far as being bruised and beaten. And he was the light of the world, and then we too are becoming the light of the world. But also, at the very tips of the branch, they had the cup where they would fill with oil. And the cup was designed in such a way that it was designed as a leaf with an almond leaf. What would that point to? The first tree to blossom in the new year or the spring is actually an almond tree. As a matter of fact, they blossom in January, if I'm not mistaken. You see the almond blossoms, they're just completely white. That points to resurrection. That's what it pointed to. So you see the lamp here, and then it's the symbolism that was portrayed there. It was made out of pure gold, pointing to deity. It had seven branches pointing to perfection. The light of the world has the seven spirits of God. You know, the seven spirits of God are listed in Isaiah chapter 1, or chapter 11, rather. It's the spirit of the Lord, the spirit of wisdom, the spirit of understanding, the spirit of counsel, the spirit of strength, the spirit of knowledge, and the spirit of fear of the Lord. These are the things that lamp pointed to. And like I said, if you looked in the tabernacle itself, the lamp was off to the south side. It was to illuminate what was going on in the tabernacle as far as the showbread, as far as the table of incense. All right. That was the only source of light in the tabernacle, but it pointed to Christ in a very, very unique way. Okay, verse 5 says, and again the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, take the Levites from among the sons of Israel and cleanse them, and thus you shall do to them for their cleansing. Sprinkle purifying water on them, and let them use a razor over their whole body, and wash their clothes, and they shall be clean. And let them take a bowl with its grain offering, the fine flour mixed with oil, and the second bowl you shall take for a sin offering. So you shall present the Levites before the tent of meeting, and you shall also assemble the whole congregation of the sons of Israel, and present the Levites before the Lord. And the sons of Israel shall lay their hands on the Levites. And Aaron then shall present the Levites before the Lord as a wave offering from the sons of Israel, that they may qualify to perform the service of the Lord. Now the Levites shall lay their hands on the heads of the bulls, then offer one for a sin offering and the other for a burnt offering to the Lord, to make atonement for the Levites. And you shall have the Levites stand before Aaron and before his sons, so as to present them as a wave offering to the Lord. Thus you shall separate the Levites from among the sons of Israel, and the Levites shall be mine. Now, here's another, I think, very interesting thing. Now they take the Levites. The Levites were the priestly tribe, okay? They were the ones to help out Aaron and his sons. Aaron and his sons were the only ones that could enter into the tabernacle. They were the only ones that could light the lamp. They were the only ones that could put bread on the table, showbread. And only the high priest could go into the Holy of Holies. And he could only go in there once a year. And he could only go in on a Day of Atonement. Okay, remember the Day of Atonement? Where they would have two goats. And what would happen is the high priest would lay his hands on one goat. He would transfer all the sins of the nation onto this one goat. And then that goat that all the sins were transferred on, that goat was taken out into the wilderness and let go free. And then they had a goat standing beside him, which was the innocent goat. That goat was offered up as a sin offering. And then they would take the blood of that sin offering from that goat, and the high priest would go into the Holy of Holies, and he'd sprinkle it on top of that mercy seat. This is the mercy seat here, right here.
God dwelt right here above the mercy seat, but they'd sprinkle the blood there, and it's like God would look down on that mercy seat. Remember what was inside that ark? It was the Ten Commandments, Aaron's rod, and manna. All right. In other words, showing that how we have all broke God's moral laws and how we've all spurned His provisions as far as the manna is concerned and spurned His authority as far as Aaron's budded rod. So when God looked down, He didn't see us breaking all these commandments. He saw that blood of the innocent animal prefiguring Jesus Christ. Okay? And every blood sacrifice, you could almost look at it like this. Every blood sacrifice, it didn't really take away sins. It didn't take away sins at all. All right, it covered over the sins, but it's almost as though Jesus Christ, with every blood sacrifice, He would say to His Father, I'm going to make that good. I'm going to make that good. I'm going to make that good. So when He died, then He made it all good. He paid the price for the whole thing, and then everyone that believed in Him could get to heaven. But you look at what they did to these priests. It said they shaved all their hair. I guess they didn't shave their beards or their heads. It just said on their body. That's kind of significant. Of course, it was a purifying ritual, but why the hair? Okay, hair, in a sense, it can stand for a few different things, but in the Bible, remember Samson? His strength was tied up in his hair. So what it was basically saying in a symbolic way was that the Levites and the priests had to be shaved from head to toe, except for their, I guess, for their beard and their hair. It was just their body hair, it says here. All right, symbolizing, showing this, everything that's going to be done for God must be done through God's Spirit. Nothing can be done through human energy and human strength and human ingenuity. See what I'm saying? Like what I'm doing right now, I've been teaching this Bible study for 33 years about, all right? Well, I'm telling you right now, if I'm doing this in human strength and human energy, I'm totally wasting your time and my time. And I think we all just turn on a TV and watch some mindless show. Because this is wasting God's time, my time, and your time. And as a matter of fact, I revolt at the thought of just taking God's word and teaching it in the flesh. God's Spirit has to be working through me. Isn't that what Jesus said? He said, hey, apart from me, you can do nothing. He said, I am the vine, you are the branches. And apart from me, you can do nothing. So if God's speaking through me, then that shows that I'm not speaking in human energy and human strength or whatever. So that's why I think that was symbolizing that everything that we do for God must be done with God's anointing and through God's Spirit. And also, you know, he's talking about here the sin offering that would have to be made. Remember, I'll just briefly mention what they would do to the sin offering. This was different from the burnt offering and the peace offering because basically what they would do for the sin offering is this. They would cut open the animal. They would put its entrails on the altar, exposing it to the light, showing that it was an acceptable sacrifice inside and out. But then they would take the carcass of the animal, they'd take it outside of the camp to a clean place, and they would burn it. Because it was sin offering, it couldn't go on God's altar. But the entrails of the animal went up on God's altar, showing that it was a perfect sacrifice, but it was taken outside the camp. Interesting, when we read in Hebrews, in the book of Hebrews, it says that Jesus Christ went outside the city. All right? And he was crucified at Golgotha, the place of the skull, right? Outside the city. But he was the perfect offering. All of this pointed to Jesus, and all of this is our tutor, what we're reading here tonight. That verse 8 says, and then they take a bowl with its grain offering, the fine flour mixed with oil. Interesting. I talked about the fine flour earlier, so I'm not going to get into it, but it said that they would put oil on top of the fine flour. What did the oil represent?
Holy Spirit.
It represented the Holy Spirit. In other words, Jesus Christ was bruised and he was crushed for our iniquities. But you know what? He never lacked power. When he hung on that cross, he could have came off that cross. All right. The only thing that constrained him was his love. It wasn't the nails. He could have come off of there and slain all mankind with just a glance. And he himself said that he could ask his Father to send legions of angels to rescue him. But he did this all on his own. So he never lacked power. In other words, when it says here, a flour offering mixed with oil. Anyway, what happened was when they consecrated the Levites, the people would lay hands upon them. This was their ordination, and now they were in a position to perform their duties before God. In verse 14, it says, thus you shall separate the Levites from among the sons of Israel, and the Levites shall be mine. Then after the Levites may go in to serve at the tent of meeting, but you shall cleanse them and present them as a wave offering. Now, a wave offering was something that you took the offering, and you actually waved it before God. You waved it before Him, and then you took it back. All right, this was that type of wave offering. I know it gets kind of complicated. They had a wave offering, they had a heave offering, they had all these different offerings. But the wave offering was symbolically showing that, okay, these people are consecrating these people to God, the priests, but then God's giving the priest back to the people. Because the priests represent God to man and man to God. And we are told by Peter in the New Testament that we are all priests. Now, we're not all ordained priests, all right? But in a sense, we all represent God to man and man to God when we come to Jesus Christ. I mean, parents need to be in that position where they represent God to man and man to God. Their children to God and their God to their children. All right, they stand in the place of a priest, and that's part of the function of a priest. So that's why it's called a wave offering. You know, you dedicate yourself to the Lord, and then you give him back to mankind, you know, and that's in that respect. Then he says here, verse 15, he says, then after the Levites may go in to serve the tent of meeting, but you shall cleanse them and present them as a wave offering. Verse 16, for they are wholly given to me from among the sons of Israel. I have taken them for myself instead of every first issue of the womb, the firstborn of all the sons of Israel. For every firstborn among the sons of Israel is mine among the men and among the animals on the day that I struck down all the first born in the land of Egypt, and I sanctified them for myself. In other words, God is saying that all the firstborn males, both animals and men, were to be dedicated to him. But instead of taking all the firstborn male of everybody in Israel, he just took one tribe, and they were to represent, you know, all the firstborn of the entire nation. And in verse 18 it says, but I have taken the Levites instead of every firstborn from among the sons of Israel, and I have given the Levites as a gift to Aaron and to his sons from among the sons of Israel to perform the service of the sons of Israel at the tent of meeting, and to make atonement on behalf of the sons of Israel, that there may be no plague among the sons of Israel by their coming near to the sanctuary. Thus did Moses and Aaron and all the congregation of the sons of Israel to the Levites according to all that the Lord had commanded Moses concerning the Levites. So the sons of Israel did to them. The Levites too purified themselves from sin and washed their clothes, and Aaron presented them as a wave offering before the Lord, and Aaron also made atonement for them to cleanse them. Then after that, the Levites went in to perform their service in the tent of meeting before Aaron and before his sons, just as the Lord had commanded Moses concerning the Levites, so they did to them. Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, this is what applies to the Levites. From the 25 years old and upward, they shall enter to perform service in the work of the tent of meeting. But at the age of 50 years, they shall retire from service in the work and not work anymore. They may, however, assist their brothers in the tent of meeting to keep an obligation, but they themselves shall do no work. Thus you shall deal with the Levites concerning their obligation. Now, the reason I read the rest of this passage is because it's still dealing with the priest, but he says a couple of interesting things that I'm going to mention in closing. First of all, if you look at this, he says in verse 24, this is what applies to Levites from 25 years old and upward. They shall enter to perform the service of the work of the tent of meeting. Does anybody remember a different age that the Levites were given? When we read, I think, in chapter 4. What was that? What was that age? The age was 30. Okay? The age was 30. So here he's saying 25. So why the discrepancy? What is he saying? He's basically saying this, all right? You can't start your priestly role until you hit 30. But when you get to be 25, you can act as an apprentice. In other words, what would happen is that for 5 years, you would work in an apprenticeship, and you would work side by side with the priests and with the Levites. You wouldn't be able to do the work, but they would instruct you in everything you had to do. And then when you each reached age 50, you could no longer do the work either. But it says here that you could stay there and act as an instructor, act as a teacher, all right, to these apprentices or to these priests and to these Levites. All right, I think this is very instructive in many respects. As a matter of fact, if I'm not mistaken, I think in the book of Chronicles, David even started the apprenticeship earlier. He started him around 20. So I think it's very, very instructive, because what it means is this. These guys just didn't go in there cold turkey at age 30. They said, well, now you're old enough, go in there and be a priest. He wouldn't have any idea. Well, what do I do? What am I supposed to do? I don't get it. You know? No. You start teaching them early on what to do and how to do it and when to do it, so they can perform their functions efficiently and know what they're doing when their time came. And I think that this is very instructive, because God always has a training period. in every one of our lives. It's an instructing period. When a person gets saved, I mean, he just doesn't cut them loose on the world, all right, to go out there and do great things. A lot of times, he will deal with a person, well, in secret. I mean, this is actually what happened to Paul. If you remember when we read it, when he got saved, it said he actually went to Arabia. And he spent a great deal of time in Arabia where the Lord instructed him before he went out and set the world on fire. Same thing with Moses. He spent 40 years in Egypt, and then how many years did he spend down in Midian? Completely in obscurity. He spent 40 years down there. All right? We see this in the life of Christ, that he spent this time of obscurity, but it was like at the same time, it was a time of preparation. I think pastors, ministers, priests, or whoever, I think they're very, very foolish if they get up on Sunday morning and to get up to the pulpit and they're just going to shoot from the hip. That's not going to work. You have to really prepare yourself, and you have to be prepared, and you have to prepare your sermons, and you have to prepare your services with a great deal of diligence, a great deal of prayer, a great deal of preparation. I think that's what this is pointing to, the importance that these priests had, all right, that they were to perform their duties in a very, very efficient manner. I mean, look at what we have today. All kinds of ministers throughout this country that are doing what? I remember they had a few years back, they had right here in Sacramento, they had two lesbians being married, and I think it was Episcopalian Church, but they had something like 80 different ministers from different denominations that were there to give their support to this. Now, these are the leaders. What are these leaders doing? Hey man, they're going to bring tremendous wrath upon themselves and upon their congregations. I mean, we have to really take, you know, spiritual leadership seriously. And I'm telling you right now, I would rather stand before God on Judgment Day as a gross, flagrant, unrepentant sinner that just spent my whole life just in selfish ambition and just fulfilling every, you know, lustful desire and just doing my own thing, stand before God like that, than to stand before God having spent my life in a pulpit or, you know, knocking on doors with a Bible and having twisted and distorted and perverted and denied it and tortured God's word to get it to say things he doesn't say. I mean, I think there's a heck of a judgment that's going to be waiting for these people to do that. We are told in James, don't all of you become teachers, brothers, because you're going to incur a much stricter judgment. And these Levites, these modern-day Levites, these modern-day priests or ministers or pastors that are misleading people, they're going to have a lot to account for. You know what I mean? That's why this is such a serious thing. You know, like I said, we've been through some pretty tough chapters here, you know, but I'm not going to skip over them. And I think that starting next week, I think the whole momentum of this book will start picking up, because now we're going to get into historical events when they're actually going to break camp and they're actually going to start heading towards the Promised Land, you know, and the number of things that happen, you know, to them on the way. It's going to be very instructive to us. Anybody have anything want to add or share?